Shantipats, this is the one that's usually connected with the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Translation of it, something like this. Om, may the Lord protect the two of us. That's the teacher and the student. May he protect both of us. May he give us both success. May he give us power. Power to successfully prosecute this study. May he make our attempt at learning effective, Tejasvi. May we not become inimical one against another. Shanti, shanti, peace. Okay. So we begin with the very first verse. You can follow in your translations. Om Vamavadino Vadanti Kim Karanam Brahma Kutatsma Jata Jivama Kena Kwacha Sampratishta Adishtita Tena Suketareshu Vartamahe Vamavido Vyavastam. Translation. Some sages who were seriously inclined to discuss the Supreme Truth asked, O knowers of the Supreme, what is Brahman, the cause of this world? From what were we born? What sustains our life? To what do we return after death? And by what arrangement are we made to live in unhappiness? Okay, so that's the first verse. We have two commentaries. I have access to two commentaries on this Upanishad, published by one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, Sri Bhakti Swarup Siddhanti Maharaj. There's the commentary from the Sri Sampradaya, from the followers of Ramanujacharya. Ramanujacharya himself, although he discussed the Upanishads in various of his works, he didn't write separate commentaries on the particular Upanishads. 500 years later, Sri Ranga Ramanuja, one of the Acharyas following him, wrote commentaries on 15 or 16 different Upanishads, including Shvetashvatara. So we're going to use Ranga Ramanuja's commentary, and that was published because previously there was no commentaries on the Upanishads written by any followers of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Prabhupada's godbrother published the old commentary from the Sri Sampradaya, and one godbrother of his in the Gaudiya Math, a pandit named Nitya Gopal Panchatirtha, wrote a commentary recently that's published in this edition. So I'm also referring to his commentary. So we'll take advantage of both their ideas. So, okay, in this verse, according to Ranga Ramanuja, he comments that in the beginning of this chapter, the purpose of the discussion is to identify what is Brahman, the absolute truth. Because the word Brahman is used all the time in the Upanishads. It comes from the root brim, which means to increase or become full, complete. The absolute, complete truth is called Brahman. The whole basic assumption of the Upanishads is that there's an absolute unity in existence. There's one absolute truth that unifies everything. So this Upanishad begins with the question, what actually is that Brahman? This is spoken, it says, by the Brahmavadis. These sages, renounced sages, sannyasis, were sitting together, and they started discussing among one another, just as equals. And they raised these questions, all in reference to what is the identity of the Absolute Truth. So here in this context, we're not questioning, these sages are not questioning, is there an Absolute Truth? Is there one reality, ultimate reality? That they're assuming. They're going beyond that question to the more essential question of what is the nature of that Absolute Truth? Assuming there is Brahman, what is that Brahman? And they also, the way they speak, they're assuming that Brahman is something beyond spirit and matter as we know them. This visible world has an ultimate cause beyond what is visible. And even the living entity is not the ultimate cause. So one way of phrasing their basic question is, who is that Brahman? What devata, what demigod, what god is the Absolute? And the second half of the verse, first of all, the first question is, what is the cause of everything? And then, secondly, not only everything material, all the elements, and everything visible, but also we, the living entities, what is our origin, specifically? And what sustains us in our existence? Assuming that we're not capable of creating ourselves or sustaining ourselves, there's something beyond us, apparently, that is our origin and our source of maintenance. And then third, fourth question, kvacha sampratishta. So here the word sampratishta, although sometimes the word can mean support, but that question's already been asked. With the support of what do we live? Jivama kena. So when it's asked again, kvacha sampratishta, another meaning of the word has to be taken. Sampratishta also means the final destination of something, or that into which something is dissolved. So where do we go? Where does everything go after annihilation? And then another more ethical question is asked in the second half of the verse. Why do we have to suffer in this existence? What is it that makes us suffer unhappiness? Or in the poetic expression given here, by what arrangement are we made to live in unhappiness? Okay, so any other commentary? The question is, what is the sarup of Brahman? What is the identity of the Absolute Truth? This Absolute Truth, we can understand, is the basic cause of existence in two ways. It's the immediate effective cause, the intelligence that impels creation. But it's also the raw ingredients of creation. It's the intelligence, the living force, that produced this world. But it's also the matter, or the substance out of which the world is created. So Brahman is understood here. It's assumed. The sages who are asking the questions are assuming Brahman is both the effective and ingredient cause of creation. What is called nimitta karanam and upadana karanam, or the active agent person, if you want to say, that arranges creation, that impels it by his desire, and also the raw ingredients, the substance out of which the world is created. Brahman is both of these. Okay. Another way to phrase the question, alternately, is, well, is Brahman really the cause of creation? We have the concept of the Absolute Truth, the one underlying reality. But that absolute reality is transcendental, is spiritual. Is that same Brahman also the cause of the material creation? Brahman is perfect. This world is imperfect. So does Brahman really have a connection with this world? Is it really the creator? Or is something else the cause of creation? In the next verse, the sages are going to speculate on this point. Maybe something else is the cause of creation. Like, for example, time. Or the material, or material nature itself. Well, objection is raised here, theoretically. The Shruti, the Shastra says, Brahman is the cause, according to the authority of the scripture. As it states in the Taittiriya Upanishad, Yato va imani bhutani jayante. And as stated in the Vedanta Sutra, Janmadyasa yataha. Brahman is that from which everything takes its birth. That is stated in scripture. So if we accept the authority of the Vedic scripture, why do we even question? So here the objection is, why should we even raise this question? Is Brahman the cause? We should, or something else? So the answer is, yes, there's no reason to ask, but people ask anyway. People doubt that the absolute truth is the cause of everything. So we have to raise these doubts and discuss them, even though they're not reasonable. And someone could argue, theoretically, Brahman is purely spiritual. This world is material. Brahman isn't supposed to have any activity. It's supposed to be changeless. Activity means changing, moving from one place to another, or changing your shape. It's some sort of transformation. So Brahman doesn't change. That means Brahman should mean that Brahman doesn't have any activity, and Brahman shouldn't produce any products, any fruits, like a tree or a human being that has a child. That's a transformation. Brahman doesn't change, so Brahman shouldn't produce any products either. Therefore, Brahman can't be the cause of material creation. The absolute truth cannot be the cause of creation. That argument can be given, theoretically. So therefore, to answer that kind of theoretical argument, even though it's wrong, even though it's unfounded, still, to answer those kinds of doubts, the question should be raised, what actually is the cause of creation? Is it Brahman or something else? And then the question in the second half is, Brahman is sukhatmaka. It's fully blissful. Brahman suffers no unhappiness. The absolute truth is pure bliss. So if Brahman is the cause of our existence, and Brahman sustains our existence, why are we unhappy? If we come from the supremely happy, and we're maintained by the supremely happy, why aren't we happy? Why are we unhappy? That seems to make the absolute truth, you can say the absolute truth is cruel and biased, because one person enjoys, another person suffers. So there's different degrees of enjoyment and suffering. Brahman is cruel to make anyone suffer, and he's unfair to let someone enjoy relatively in comparison to another person. So all these questions are there. These sages are expressing these doubts. They may be expressing their own doubts or just speaking for the benefit of others. In any case, we have to give them credit. They're following the proper process. They're asking questions. And we will see in two verses that although they begin by speculating, one of the sages among them, named Shvetashvatara, proves to be more realized than the others, and they accept him as authority. And from that point on, he speaks his realizations and they listen. So they're following the proper process. They have doubts, but they raise them in a proper assembly. And when there's a person available who has authority who can answer the questions, they accept his authority and they hear him out. That is the method of Upanishadic education. The word Upanishad means Upanishad. To sit, shad means to sit down. Nishad means to sit down. And upa means near. So when a disciple approaches a spiritual master, and not only does some puja and asks for some blessings, but he sits down He asks some serious questions, and he stays sitting and sits out patiently and listens to the answers. That's Upanishad. Okay, just looking at the verse quickly, looking at the structure of the verse poetically, just at some of the words here. Kim karanam brahma. This is referring to the list of repetitions, so the echoes, these numbers on the top and the whole section here. First of all, this word Brahman is going to be repeated again in 20 different verses. There's 113 verses altogether in the Upanishad. 20 of those verses again use the same word Brahman. So this idea of the absolute truth is repeated over, it's a basic theme of the Upanishad. And the way Brahman or the Absolute is described over and over again, his qualities are described. Brahman is not being characterized as having no qualities, no form, not in this Upanishad. And very often, in the same verses where the Absolute Truth is called Brahman, which we sometimes think means the impersonal conception of the Supreme, that same Brahman, in the same verses, is also called Deva, the personality of Godhead. So the word Brahman is not being used here to exclusively mean impersonal conception of the Supreme. It is the Absolute Truth not excluding his personality. That is also included. And continuing here. Okay, this word jata, the question was, from what are we born? What are we, the living entities, born from? So the word jata is there. That idea will be repeated again too. Later in the second chapter, there's some mention about how Brahma took birth, four-headed Brahma, from Lord Vishnu, and how the other demigods and living entities took their births at the beginning of creation. And that's also repeated again in the fourth chapter. This question, first question, Kim Karanam, what is the basic cause of creation? Karanam. There's going to be three times that question is directly answered. In verse 3, in the beginning of Shvetashvata, or the beginning of the description of the sages' realization in their meditation, there is a first answer to that in verse 1-3. And then at the end, in the last chapter, in verses 9 and 16, and 13 rather, the question, what is the basic cause of creation, will be directly answered again in the sixth chapter. Okay. Then these sages are called Brahmavadis. And then in the verse, they address themselves as Brahmavit, knowers of Brahman. Brahmavadi means one who is seeking after Brahman, looking for the Absolute Truth. And Brahmavit means someone who knows the Absolute Truth. So this is an important idea. Theme, one who knows the Absolute Truth, he will become immortal. He's successful in life. And certainly that's the person you should approach for knowledge and guidance, the Brahmavit. So this theme, or this word, vid, vidaha, the knower of the truth, this is also repeated in 21 different verses. Ramanujacharya, in his philosophy, emphasizes the idea that transcendental knowledge and devotion are the same. They're not separate processes. Transcendental knowledge, when it's perfected, becomes devotional service. Okay, that's the first verse. We'll have to move on because I took a little too much time on it. Okay, so after we'll do five verses today if we can manage, and then we'll have a little time for questions. So second verse. Kalam svabhavo niyatirya dhritcha bhutani yonik purusha inti chintyam samyoga esham natvatma bhavad Atmapyanisha sukaduka hetoho. Okay, so the sages are still speaking to each other. We can only speculate that maybe time is this cause, or else the laws of nature, or rather the laws of the universe, or fate, or chance, or the physical elements, or Mother Nature, or the soul who enjoys her. Since the living soul exists, the cause of creation cannot be merely the combination of material factors. But the soul himself also cannot be the creator of happiness and distress. Okay, so there are various... the sages here are presenting the ideas that different kinds of people have. There are people who believe in different philosophies, and they have different ideas of what the cause of creation is. Ramanujacharya comments that there are people who believe as their philosophy that time is the cause of everything. There are other people, the Lokayatikas, or the materialists who follow Charvaka Muni, or similar materialistic, anti-spiritualist spiritual philosophies. They say that everything in the world has its own intrinsic nature. There's no external cause. Fire is hot because that's the way fire is. There's no intelligence, there's no higher cause. That's materialism. Then there are the followers of Jaimini Rishi, the Karma Mimamsa philosophers. They say that karma itself, impersonal karma, destiny, is the ultimate cause and controller of everything. The demigods are offered sacrifices, but the question of whether the demigods are real or whether they're just fictional, that doesn't matter. They're just useful fictions, the demigods and the idea of God. Karma, the law of karma, is the real essence of everything, the real cause of creation, the real regulator. That's the Karma Mimamsa philosophy. Some people say there's no cause. Things are just happen by chance. There's no reason to even speculate for any reason why things happen the way they do. And on and on. So the sages, after listing these different possible causes of existence, they then comment that these can't be, all these conceptions of what is the cause of creation, they're all faulty. Each one of these entities is inadequate to be the ultimate cause. Samyoga esham. Not even if you combine all of them together, because they're all inert material things. Time, even nature, the individual nature qualities of things, these are all insufficient because they're just inert material objects. So someone may propose that, okay, the jiva, the living being, let him be considered the cause of creation. But our commentators explain, or the sages comment, atmat yanishaha sukha dukha heto. The soul can't be considered the cause of creation because he doesn't have the power to control his own happiness and suffering. Although the jiva chooses his suffering, in that sense he has control, his happiness rather, he has control over his happiness. He voluntarily enjoys. He has an opportunity to enjoy himself, and he chooses it. But he doesn't voluntarily choose his suffering. He's not in control to that extent. So taking the happiness and suffering together, he's not in control. Even of that, what does speak of being the controller of everything? So atma pidisha. Because he can't even control his own happiness and distress, he doesn't have... the power to be the supreme controller. Okay, so now we're going to move on to verse 3. Before that, let's look at the text itself here. This verse and the next 11 verses occur in another Upanishad, just if anybody's interested. There's one minor Upanishad, not very well known, called the Narada Parivrajakacharya Upanishad. It's spoken by Narada Muni. And in that Upanishad, which is a few hundred verses long, the ninth chapter of that Upanishad, the first 11 verses spoken by Narada are an exact repetition verses 2 through 12 of this first chapter. Here the jiva is called Anishaha. Isha means Lord. Or even more literally, Isha means capable. The person who's capable of controlling, he's the Isha, the Lord. So the jiva is characterized as called Anisha, not Isha here. Literally means he's incapable. He's incapable, because here it's being stated, he's incapable of controlling his own happiness and distress. So that is the typical characteristic of the jiva. He's not the controller. He's not capable of controlling his own life even. And that same phrase, Anisha, will be used again three more times in the Upanishad. And every time the jiva is called Anisha, in the same verse, the Lord is contrasted. He's called Isha, the controller. The jiva is called not the controller, Anisha. He's also called the Atma, the spirit soul. That word Atma is used 20 times again in 20 different verses. Sometimes it refers to the jiva, sometimes it refers to the supreme soul, and sometimes the word Atma refers to the subtle body or the gross body. Here we're talking about the jiva, his happiness and distress. So here it's implied that pursuing happiness and trying to avoid distress is a valid goal in life. It's not materialistic, it's not unjustifiably selfish. The living entity should try to be happy and avoid being unhappy. That theme is repeated over and over again, the idea of happiness and unhappiness. Okay, so we move on to the third verse. Okay, after speaking like this among each other, among one another, raising some questions, then the sages decide to sit down in meditation and see what they can realize by meditating. So, verse 3. Te dhyana yoganugata apashyan devatma shaktim swagunaya nirudham yakkaranani nikalani tani kalatma yuktan yaritishyat yekaha. Concentrating their minds in meditation, the sages then perceived the Supreme's creative energy endowed with his qualities. They also saw the Supreme in person. The effulgent Lord, who alone is the foundation of all causes in creation, including time and the soul. So, obviously, this is very ancient. Upanishad is in the context of a very elevated ancient civilization when people were very intelligent. These intelligent sages could sit down and collectively together meditate and share their experience in their meditation. And when they meditated, they saw the Supreme Person along with his internal creative energy. So that implies that they were very elevated, very qualified. But to have a mystic experience is one thing. Vedic revelation is more than just mystic experience. Every religious and spiritual tradition in the world has some is based on somebody's mystic experience. There are so many mystic sages. You find them in Christianity and Islam. Every religion has them. But what is special about Vedic revelation is that it's not just founded on personal mystic experience. The Vedic sages have a higher qualification than that. Not just that they saw God in their meditation, but they, when they came back from their meditation, they were empowered to describe the Absolute Truth scientifically and to teach ordinary people how to realize the Absolute Truth. The Vedic revelation, what was spoken and later written down, the revelation given by the Vedic sages, is a scientific, systematic method of God realization that any person who is faithful, honest, and a little intelligent can follow. So this Upanishad begins with some speculative questions. And now in the third verse is moving on to some mystic experience. And that mystic experience will now last for another two verses, to the fifth verse. But then it moves up to the higher Vedic level. The authoritative voice of the sage Shvetashvatara is going to give systematic understanding, tattva gyan. Okay, so they saw two things here. The spiritual energy of the Supreme and the Supreme Person himself with his energy. The phrase is Devatma Shakti. Deva, we understand the word Deva to mean God. But originally this word comes from the verb div, which means to shine. It's of course, we know Deva can mean a demigod also. And actually, originally Deva, in the literal meaning of the word, it refers to any very elevated person who is spiritually powerful. And the word literally means shining, shining or effulgent. Or another meaning is from the verb div, to play. The Supreme Person is Lilamoy. He has his pastime, sports. So he's a playful person. That's also expressed by the word Deva. But in the word Deva is the basic conception of the personality of the Supreme Person. So they saw the Supreme Person's Atma Shakti, his personal energy, this internal energy that is under his personal control and fulfills his direct desire. And then they saw him also with his energy. Ramanujacharya gives us a citation from the Subala Upanishad. Apahata papma divyo devo ego narayanaha. Explaining the word deva. Deva is the divya lord, the divine or effulgent supreme person. Apahata papma, who is untinted, untinged by any material contamination. And his name is Narayan. So the sages saw the potency of the Supreme Lord, who acts as the cause of creation on his behalf. The creative energy of the Lord acts as both the ingredients, the substance of creation, and also she actively gives impulse to the other elements of creation to evolve. And then they saw, in the second half of the verse, it describes how they saw the Lord himself. Ramanujacharya's understanding is that God, that the energy of God comprises the body of God. Just like we are the souls of our own bodies. And there's a relationship between soul and body. The body is controlled by the soul. It's given energy by the soul. And the soul knows his own body. Knows, controls, and impels the activity of his body. Similarly, everything that exists, including the material energy, the jivas, and all the spiritual energy, all of this is emanating from God, is controlled by God, is given life by God, and God knows absolutely everything about his own energies. So everything together makes up the body of God in that scientific sense of what is the relationship between soul and body. That's what the sages are experiencing here in their meditation. And this, knowing this is not possible through other means of knowledge. You can't, ordinary people with their ordinary perception cannot understand this. You can't understand this by logical deduction, by mathematics, or ordinary philosophical speculation. Only by transcendental realization. Here the sages are having some personal realization, but it's not articulate. It's not a systematic understanding. They see, but it doesn't mean that they've developed their personal relationship with God. It doesn't mean that they can help anybody else come to this realization. They've just had a momentary experience, some meditational, mystic experience. This is still incomplete. Okay. Okay, now I want to bring in one reference from the Vedanta Sutra. One remarkable feature of this Upanishad is that it's referred to repeatedly by Vyasadeva in his Vedanta Sutra. He comments on the Shvetashvatara Upanishad very much repeatedly in his Vedanta Sutra. Here's one example referring to this verse, number 3. In the fourth chapter, there are four chapters in the Vedanta Sutra of Vyasadeva. The fourth chapter describes prayojana, or what is the success of spiritual practice? What is the goal that you can achieve? What is the result of spiritual realization? In that chapter, there's some discussion of the sadhana, process of reaching that goal. And first of all, okay, I'm reading here from Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan, the Govinda Bhasha, Gaudiya Vaishnava commentary on Vedanta Sutra. And in his commentary, he first of all quotes a verse from the second chapter of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. I'll read the verse. The wise person, in the second chapter, the process of yoga meditation, in the second chapter of this Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the sadhana, the method for practicing yoga meditation is described. And so there's one statement here, eighth verse, quoted by Baladeva Vidyabhushan. Triya unatam stapya samam shariram. The wise person should hold his body straight, keeping forward his chest, neck, and head. He should gather together his mind and senses within the heart, and with the boat of transcendental sound. He should cross each of the fearful rivers of his material life. So Baladeva Vidyabhushan quotes that verse. It says, yes, this is found in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Now we have a doubt. We may ask, well, is this stipulation of how specifically you're supposed to sit with your back straight and your neck and eyes, head erect, is this really required? Is this really necessary or not? So that's the doubt. And someone may answer the doubt saying, well, because remembrance of the Supreme is simply a function of the mind, it shouldn't matter what you do with your body, how you sit. So the first attempt at answering the doubt is to say, no, it's not important. It's not essential to follow this injunction. So Vyasadeva in Vedanta Sutra, in the Sutra chapter 4, section 1, verse 7, he says, Asina Sambhavat. This is the sutra. One should be sitting. So he's answering, no, you have to sit the proper way. You have to be sitting to meditate. One should be sitting because of the feasibility, Sambhavat, because of the feasibility of meditating on the Supreme in that position. That's the sutra. And then Baladeva Vidyabhushan explains the sutra. One should be sitting in the proper yoga posture. And in that way, one will remember Sri Hari. Why? Because then it's feasible, then it's possible. When you're lying down or standing up or walking around, your mind will become agitated, disturbed, distracted. It's very difficult to avoid that distraction. And it won't be possible to remember Lord Hari. And then he quotes this verse, verse number 3, from the first chapter of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Te dhyana yoga anu gata apashyan. In that verse, and others like it, it's described how those who wanted to come in contact, who wanted to realize the Supreme, how they carried out their meditation. They sat properly and they performed the standard process of meditation. And the word dhyana is stated here. Te dhyana yoga. So referring to this Shvetashvatara Upanishad, according to Baladeva Vidyabhushan, Vedanta Sutra points out, that the word dhyana is there. And the very next sutra, sutra number 8, says dhyanat cha, and because of the mention specifically of meditation. The sages engage in meditation, and Baladeva Devotion says the definition of dhyana or meditation is to focus your attention. Focus the attention of your mind so that it's not distracted by anything extraneous that is fixed on one goal. So the argument is, if you're sleeping or you're agitated or distracted, you can't focus your mind completely. Meditation is not possible. So therefore, the argument is one should sit properly when he's meditating. Okay, this just points out how the Vedanta Sutra, presenting the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, referred back to this verse of the Upanishad and to one other. Okay, we're going to the fourth verse. Oh, a few things here. There's one phrase here, I'm sorry. In the fourth line of the third verse, there's the phrase Adityashchat Yekaha. He alone is the foundation. Adista means to stand underneath something, to be the foundation. The demigods are called Adistata. They're the underlying controllers. We don't see the demigods. When I move my little finger, I think I'm moving it by my own strength and my own desire. But actually, there's a demigod, some demigod who's in control of the little finger of my hand. He's behind the scenes controlling that motion of my finger. Like that, the Supreme is below the surface of everything. He's standing underneath everything, maintaining and controlling everything. Adityashchat Ekaha, he alone is the foundation of everything, the controller of everything. That phrase, that those two exact same words exactly, Adityashchat Ekaha, are repeated four more times in later on in the fourth and fifth chapters of this Upanishad. The word Deva is used the first time here, meaning the Supreme Person, the effulgent Supreme Lord. That word is repeated 30 times throughout the Upanishad. Dhyana is mentioned here, that Baladeva Vibhushan defined for us, meditation. At the end of the first chapter, in the 14th verse, is going to be a recommendation that one should engage in meditation. How does it go? 14. Dhyana nirmatanabhyasad. The Absolute Truth is in one's heart. And by using the transcendental sound Om, by meditating on Om, and by that transcendental process of churning, like churning butter, dhyana nirmatana, by the churning process of meditation, one can evoke the presence, one can realize the presence of the Supreme within his heart. So there is a recommendation that one should engage specifically in the process of meditation. That's the end of the first chapter. And then the second chapter, the first half of the whole second chapter, describes in some detail how to execute the process of meditation. But the first mention of dhyana is here in the third verse. Okay. That's a basic theme of the Upanishad also. There's a very famous verse in the very last chapter. Parasya shaktir vividai vishriyate svabhaviki jnana balasya. The Supreme has many different, a whole variety of different kinds of energies which do everything on his behalf. The whole creation expands by the Lord's energies. The Lord himself doesn't change. Brahman doesn't change. But his energies change for him. The Mayavadis can't understand this. They can't understand. They think, well, the Supreme is unchangeable, therefore whatever seems to be a transformation is illusion. There's no reality to the transformations, the dualities of this world. But we understand, following the actual teachings of the Upanishads, that the Lord has his parashakti, his transcendental energies, and he has various transcendental energies. They transform on his behalf, and the varieties of creation are produced by them. And this is all real. This is not illusion. The Mayavadis cannot not understand this. They say that all the transformation, all the duality, is just illusion, imagination. That's the difference between the two kinds of impersonalists, the Brahmavadis and the Mayavadis. The sages here are called Brahmavadis because they're sincere seekers of the absolute truth. They're not. They have not. They're not prepared to realize the personality of Godhead fully. But they're not inimical to the idea of personal surrender. They're gradually approaching it. They're not envious like the Mayavadis. Okay, we have to move on to the fourth verse. So here there's a graphic, esoteric description of their meditation. Not a systematic philosophical explanation. So we shouldn't try to squeeze too much philosophical understanding out of these two verses, 4 and 5. It's more just a poetic description of their meditation. Tam eka nemim trivitam shodashantam shattar daram vimshati pratyarabihi ashtakai shadvir vishvarupaika pasham trimarga vedam trinimitaika moham. Okay, this is what they saw. They envisioned the Supreme as a wheel with one edge, three divisions, 16 endpoints, 50 spokes, 20 spoke supports, and 6 groups of 8 expansions. They saw in him as well the universal form, which is the one regulator of existence, and 3 paths of development, of which 2 lead to the same one kind of illusion. Okay, so to make some sense out of this, we should read the part of the word-for-word synonyms. So, ekanemin means having one's wheel edge, wheel's edge, one edge of the wheel. That is material nature, the wheel's edge. Material nature is one, and she expands it to many different forms. Trivritam, 3 divisions of the wheel, just like a wheel may be divided into 3 sections, each 120 degrees, like a pie. Those are the 3 modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Material nature, first of all, divides into those 3 modes. And by the combinations of the 3 modes, everything else evolves. Shodashantam, 16 endpoints. That means outside the edge of the wheel, there may be little points sticking out. There are 16 of those. And these are the 16 elements of material nature. 50 spokes of the wheel. Well, these, according to Rangu Ramanuja, these are the 50 sounds, the 50 letters in the Sanskrit alphabet. Because in material creation, everything emanates from sound first. The first element is sound, the most subtle element. The ether, because first comes the tanmatra, that which is experienced. And then the substance in which it resides is created. Sound comes first, and then the ether comes after sound. The ether evolves from sound. Sound is the first. The perception of sound is the first created element. And then comes the ether, which exists in order to accommodate sound. And from sound, everything else is created. And in fact, Brahma creates the whole world by speaking. Just like in the Bible, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Like that, everything is created by speaking, by announcing. This is this and this is that. So these 50 sounds in the Sanskrit alphabet, they're the support, the basis of existence. Everything emanates from them. And then there are sort of perpendicular supports holding, supporting or keeping these spokes straight. There are 20 of them. And these are the divisions of time. Time is the regulator of everything. Everything evolves according to the regulation of time. And time can be understood as having 20 divisions. There's 12 months, 6 seasons, and 2 halves of the year, totaling 20. And then there are 6 different groups of 8 energies of the Supreme by which he controls existence. And according to one listing, these are the 8 mystic opulences of the Lord, the 8 different directions, the 8 demigods who guard each direction, the 8 physical elements, and the 8 demigods who were in charge of each of the elements. Then there's
The sages also saw the universal form of the whole universe, which is the one controlling agent. The one, pasha means rope, or like a noose that you're hanged on. It's the cause of bondage of all the living entities. And the living entities living in this world travel on three different roads, three different paths. One path goes to the demigods, the other one goes to the forefathers, and the third one leads down into animal life. So there's activity in the mode of goodness, which leads to elevation to heaven. Activity in the mode of passion, by which you stay in this material, in the earthly planetary system. And activity in the mode of ignorance, by which one descends to animal species and goes to hell. So, three paths. Two of the paths lead to illusion. The path in passion and ignorance. The path of the forefathers and the path of animal life. They lead to further bondage. But the one path, the path of the demigods, leads to elevation. Okay, we're going to have to move on to the fifth verse. We only have a few minutes. Okay. And then they saw another vision. They saw the Supreme and His energies in another form. Pancha Shrotom Bum Pancha Yon Yugra Vatram Pancha Pranormim Pancha Budyadi Mulam Pancha Vartam Pancha Duka Oga Vegam Pancha Shad Vedam Pancha Paragamadi Maha. We meditate on him as a river with five channels covering different, carrying different waters. Five tributaries flowing with fierce-faced currents. Five waves consisting of the airs of life. The five kinds of perception as its source. Five whirlpools. Five flood currents creating unhappiness. Five branches and 50 sub-branches. Okay, so again, the word-for-word symptoms explain what these are. The five waters that are the... This verse describes the manifest material creation, the world of bondage that the living entities are enjoying and suffering in, the world of samsara, the visible world. So there's five kinds of water underlying this, this river of nature. And according to the commentator, Nitya Gopal Panchatirtha, these are called tamas, akshara, avyakta, mahat, and ahankara. And the explanation is these are the five forms of material nature in the beginning. We know that we've heard of pradhan in the Bhagavata. Pradhan is unmanifest material nature. And we know about mahatattva. After Lord Vishnu glances at pradhan, she becomes agitated. And when she's agitated and her elements are disturbed and out of balance, she's called mahatattva. And then from mahatattva comes false ego, and then all the different elements evolve. So here we just have a different characterization of the same thing, just a little more analytic. Tamas, according to what I found from the Baladeva Dibhushan's Vedanta commentary, tamas here means it's the spiritual energy of God, of Lord Narayan, from which the pradhan expands. It's the spiritual basis of material nature, the spiritual origin of material nature. He says it's the Supreme Lord's very subtle, eternal potency, particular energy of his. And from that tamas energy, the pradhan, the original form of nature, expands. So first comes tamas, then akshara means pradhan. And then when Lord Mahavishnu glances at pradhan, at the dormant material nature, she first becomes agitated by his knowledge potency. This is mentioned in the Bhagavatam, called Sutra Tattva. The Sutra Tattva, then Mahatattva. When the knowledge potency becomes active first, and then after that, the creation, the potency of material creation, of creating the material elements becomes active. So that third stage is called Avyakta. That's equivalent to the Sutra Tattva, or the pradhan with her subtle energy agitated. And then when the gross energy is agitated, that's called Mahatattva. And then fifth is Ahankara, false ego. So that describes those five. There are five tributaries, small rivers that flow into this river and bring it water. These are the five tanmatras, or the five sensations, sound, touch, and so on. The five airs of life are there. Those are like waves of the river. Five buddhis means the five knowledge-acquiring senses. Adimula. These are said to be the basic foundation of this river of material existence. And the commentators explain it. That's because it's by our knowledge-acquiring senses, our eyes, our ears, and so on, that we have any contact with this world. As far as we're concerned, our connection with existence is based on our knowledge-acquiring senses. So therefore, they're called the adimula, or the basis of this whole river of material existence. There are five whirlpools in the rivers. These are the active senses. The hands, the legs, and so on. And they cause five different kinds of misery to the living entities. 50 divisions, again, 50 sounds of the alphabet, five branches, five different kinds of illusion that are experienced in material life. They're described in the Bhagavatam in the third canto. There's a verse that says, Brahma first created the nescient engagements like self-sense of death, anger after frustration, the sense of false ownership, and the illusory bodily conception, or forgetfulness of one's real identity. These are called Sasarjagre Andatamisram, Atatamisram, Maha Moha Moha, and Tamas. These are the five forms of illusion created by Lord Brahma. They were there also there in this vision by the sages. Okay, we're going to have to stop there.